So welcome, everybody. This is the Architecting the Platform Best Practices series or session. My name is Ray Bunn. I'm a solution architect with Esri. My background is starting a couple decades ago, working with AutoCAD and ARCAD, and really in a pretty non-visual way, getting GIS data into a map and then hitting plot and going home for the night because it took so long. We've come a long way since then. So I transitioned from things like engineering and municipal planning, supported a state IT organization, so the state of New Jersey's central IT. So I have some enterprise IT background. I also supported New Jersey State Police, so 8 years of law enforcement, homeland security type application development. And now here I am at Esri in the next millennium of my career. And so the Patterns of Practices team, we perform solution architecture work. Some of you have stopped by the island. We also maintain these best practices, so we created these and we maintain the documents. And this is my colleague Jim Van Ossenbridge.
So hello everyone. Welcome to what I'm hoping will be the most exciting and invigorating talk of your entire conference experience. So I'm Jim Van Ossenbridge, also a solution architect on Esri's Patterns and Practices team. My road to my role has been a little bit different than Ray's. I spent a lot of time working with defense contractors and solution implementers, Esri partners. Prior to my role here at Esri, I've worked in our professional services division as an enterprise consultant and system design consultant as well. And I think what we're going to share with you today doesn't just leave you with some impressive material to look at, but hopefully some tools and techniques that you too can apply in determining the path forward for your work, the work of your organizations, and how we use geography and GIS as individual organizations and connected organizations. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Ray.
I have to apologize if you came here expecting Dave Raisin, because his name was on the list. He got called away, and you were stuck with me, and thankfully Jim stepped in to help. So
if you like what I have to say, my name is Jim Van Ossenbridge. If you don't like what I have to say, my name is Dave Raisin. I think we've got some meaningful insights to share with all of you today, and hopefully you'll find this material interesting and engaging. And with that, I will hand it back.
Please push the button. So in our role, it's our job really to help you be successful. This little quote kind of points you toward what we strive for. We want to help you create a strategy. The quote essentially says you wouldn't build your house without a blueprint. We could roll up to your house with all the lumber and screws and nails and plumbing and electricity and dump it on a plot of land, and some of you might put together something that resembles a house, but it might not be something you want to live in. So if you have a blueprint, it really will help you build the house that you want. It's the same with your GIS. So it's our job to help you with that blueprint, that roadmap, and help you be successful. If you've heard Chris Capelli ever say it, he says all the time, hope is not a strategy. So we want to help you with the strategy.
So if you're going to develop a blueprint. Actually, one of the things that we've worked on is a conceptual blueprint for the ArcGIS platform. Here you see the four key components of the platform: applications, a portal, infrastructure, and external systems and services. But within each of these, there are multiple decisions that you make in regard to how you're going to implement the ArcGIS platform to achieve the business outcomes intended by the organization. But there's a little bit more to that than the technology. And so that leads us in the direction of investigating essential solution elements of people, process.
Before you go too far.
Oh, I will not go too far.
You already went too far. Before we get into that, we just want to take a quick poll on some things. Also, I noticed a lot of people are taking pictures. This will point you to it later on, is available through Esri.com, so we can help you with that. So a quick poll on best practices. I just have some questions here. So how many of you right now are using some sort of publication strategy? 1, 2, 5, 6. 6. How about load balancing? About 8. High availability? Lots of hands. Right. How can there be more hands on high availability than there are on load balancing? So 10 on that one. Anybody know about our system tools? 1, 2, 3. Maybe 3 people. 4. I know 4 people because you didn't raise your hand, but I know you do. Environment isolation. Yeah, a couple. So we'll say 2. How many of you have multiple portals? 4 over here. And how many of you apply IT governance to your GIS? That's a lot. That was like 12. How many are using different types of app development approaches? So geo-enabled, geocentric, composite. A few of those, about 3. A few of you may know about our project prioritization methodology. I don't know. I know that Antonio knows. Nobody else. What's the other one? How about our essential patterns of a location strategy? 1, 2. 2 of those. So for security, how many people consider security at the very outset of your project? Lots of people. That was a good 25. And how many people are using identity in your GIS? So about 15. Okay, great.
Okay.
Sorry, Jim. I stomped all over your mojo.
No, let's find the right groove. Get it right. So, all those considerations and this conceptual stack of technology need to be weighed in. But part of the challenge of WebGIS is that it offers you an opportunity to help people work differently than they have in the past, and achieve new outcomes. And in terms of best practice, we're compelled to look at categories of people, process, and technology. And we're seeking to evolve the way people work together with geography and GIS. So what does that mean, right? So yes, the technology is a meaningful element of delivering that capability. But that has something to do with the processes that people work in together. And if they're going to work together, they have to have the right mechanisms and the right resources and able to in order to work together. So we'll be taking a look at these three key domains: people, process, and technology, as we traverse our best practices. So the question that I'd have for you is how do you explain what it is that you do, what it is that you do with GIS for people to other people that don't really know much about GIS? And over our company's history, we've worked with customers across various domains to reveal these six patterns that are essential to a location strategy. If I could pull back a curtain here, Ray would be very entertained. These six patterns, and just kind of step through them and define them for you, help set the stage. And let's start from the right side of the diagram, where our focus is location data management. And it's important to consider that all information systems are built on a foundation of authoritative information. It's not really useful to have an information system for an enterprise if the content within it is not timely and authoritative. So here we need to build that foundation upon which all these other activities are enabled. Out of that mountain of information, we distill actionable information through the use of analytics, right? So we'd like to get down to the key pieces of information that are going to help people take action and guide decisions in the organization. Oftentimes, we need to be able to take content with us to the field. We might work with content in a connected or disconnected way. And ultimately, we do this with the purpose of maintaining that foundational content such that people in the organization who are not GIS experts, executives, managers, knowledge workers, can access and apply geographic information without having to become GIS experts. Right, that's our decision support pattern. The constituent engagement pattern is similar to the decision support pattern, but it differs in that decision support focuses on information products and capabilities for those people within an organization. Constituent engagement is those capabilities for those outside of your immediate organization. And then location enablement, you see that L shape there? That's where we enable people to discover, use, make, and share maps. I mean, this is where we provide our gateway controls so the right people can access the right content for the right purpose. So what we found to be interesting about these six patterns is that certainly they have something to do with technology, but they also have an awful lot to do with practice. So in terms of people, we look to these patterns to help guide us into how would we identify the critical roles that are associated with managing content, with performing analysis, with working with field data, so on and so forth. And ensuring that we have the right people in the right roles with the right skills in the solutions that we design to do that work. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that if you look at these patterns and think of these categories as we do, you may find it a little bit easier to categorize requests that come at you. And for any of you that have visited us and visited our team in the expo hall during the course of the conference, you've seen us diagram out using these six patterns. There's an essential categorization here also, that the three patterns on the right represent something that we've termed an industry term of a system of record. Again, our authoritative content. You know, the patterns to the right represent a system of engagement. That's
the other right. your other right.
My other right. Yes. Strike that. Reverse it. What's interesting is that you can't really have a system of engagement without a meaningful system of record, right? People are not going to use people who aren't GIS experts are certainly not going to use applications and capabilities that don't provide them with authoritative and timely information. The system of record is not really justifiable unless it's providing a system of engagement. Right? So you want to be able to gain value from the investments in information by creating the channels for consumption and application of it. Everyone's seeing that this is a method that you could use to help to kind of clarify how people would work together in your organization. So if you're going to have people...
Question?
Yes. Yeah, fire away.
This slide seems to be an evolution of something over the last couple of years where the arrow went through the middle.
Yes, correct.
Is there anything that you can share as to deeper thought on how that happened? I mean, what is different about it?
Okay, so the question is that an earlier version of this slide had an arrow through the center that basically highlighted a complete system, right? It's still a complete system. The way that we've evolved in our thinking is that the location enablement pattern is really not something that stands by itself all the way on that other side. The shape of it is intentional. That access controls are relevant across all the patterns, not just the ones in the system of engagement. They're all still essential patterns. Work the right way together to allow people to apply geography and GIS effectively. Originally, we started with four, which ultimately was decision support, field mobility, and analytics and location data management, and we've extended it from there.
I think another key point about the patterns is they are evolving because the platform is evolving. So as the platform expands, as we have new apps, new capabilities, these patterns are just morphing a little bit.
Does that help? Okay. So... an essential element of working together is that everybody has an identity, right? So this is I had the conceptual reference architecture up earlier. So the portal tier was there. In the portal tier of our architecture, we configure users with roles and privileges to access the right content and capability to do their work. That gets incorporated into the applications that they leverage in their workflows against organizational content. I saw many of you were already working with identity in your solutions. And has this been a challenging concept for some of you to implement I would imagine at times it can be so. Because the identity landscape is not necessarily as easy to navigate as just pushing one button, right? There's a lot to consider, because now you're tracing not just an enterprise identity, an Active Directory into the GIS. You're actually looking at the workflows and the content that needs to be exposed in the activities of people in your enterprise. So there are some considerations along the way that are worth weighing in. Any thoughts? So again, It's about, if we think about this from a people perspective, key best practice is workforce development. Solutions are not just technology; they are built for people, right? And certain people in certain roles require the appropriate skills to support essential processes within the enterprise. And so, part of a solution investment includes ensuring that you have the right the personnel and the right skill categories to be able to deliver a solution sustainably. Right? We talked about high availability. Has anyone in the room ever encountered a high availability scenario from a human perspective? Like, who gets the call in the middle of the night when the system's down? So, if you've gotten the call in the middle of the night when the system's down, I apologize. I know that's a tough thing to have to resolve, but that's an issue relative to workforce development, to ensure that you have the right personnel with the right skills to keep things going, because those personnel that are using applications and content in the system of engagement, they're not really too concerned about what happens behind the scenes, but that the map is on when they ask for it, right?
Jim, you're an example of high availability.
Am I?
Dave Raisin went offline and you came right on.
Yes, I am the backup system. I feel so much better about myself now. Hopefully there won't be a need for disaster recovery. one of the challenges that we see with solutions is that their process of becoming has a lot to do ultimately with governance. So I saw a number of hands relative to IT governance in an organization. Is there a lot of change management process that goes along with that for you? Corporate IT says thou shalt do X, Y, and Z to ensure that new solutions are tested before they're rolled out. There's an essential paradigm to this, and that is in operations, things don't break. Though they do, they're not supposed to ever, right? In development, things are supposed to break until they don't, right? So you keep on working on your new solution and developing, testing, breaking, fixing, testing again, code and unit tests until you get to the point of some kind of stable release. But beyond that, beyond the obligations of operations and development, there's an essential need to make decisions about the scope of the solution, the capabilities that are to be deployed, what new capabilities are priorities for an organization to build and deliver, so that the organization can do business differently, can evolve in its capability and move forward in a meaningful and coordinated manner. So out of that that spectrum of possibilities, it's somewhat important to be able to set some priorities.
I just want to ask before we start on this, on the last slide, based on the things that Jim just said, how many people would change the way they do governance and maybe implement more IT governance on their systems? Anybody?
Can I say something?
Yes, you may.
At least in my experience, usually the challenge is you can set up the governance procedure. It's the ability to enforce it. But usually, GIS is a subset of
right.
A subset.
Right. some organizations just don't manage their GIS like they manage their enterprise IT. And that's so. Right. That was maybe three people.
So his question, what do you think is best practice on that? Should GIS be rolled into the enterprise IT? Should it be separate?
If you have an enterprise GIS system, then it definitely should have IT governance. You want change control. You want someone to determine the next generation of capabilities, somebody to create that, all the things that Jim was saying. Without that, you just have a server under a desk, and it's probably not going to be high availability. It's not going to be there when you want it. It may not be backed up. All those things have happened for years. Many organizations just haven't sort of elevated it to that level.
So I've been in charge of GIS for about a year, and I come from an IT background. And I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to get, because our GIS was separate from our enterprise IT, and I'm trying to get it, trying to get the GIS to start through IT governance, change management.
Yeah.
Have our server supported by our data center instead of our GIS developers. So why do you think historically that's been the case? Why has that not happened? And it's still not happening in a lot of cases.
It just wasn't seen as an enterprise system. It sort of has organically grown inside the organization. But we can talk more about that offline if you want to come up after. Otherwise, we'll run out of time because we could be here all day talking about governance. So this slide, project prioritization, is a best practice because it fits perfectly within the ArcGIS platform. So along the bottom, the challenges, right? Challenges or risk go down as you move that way, and value goes up here. For many years, if you ever participated in the let's build it and they will come paradigm, you were working potentially down here, and sometimes they just users never arrived. They didn't like your app or it didn't do what they wanted. So ArcGIS has been engineered largely for the upper right-hand corner with the ability to configure maps and apps and capabilities very quickly, very rapidly. You can determine your high business value information products, configure them very quickly, and get them deployed. In some cases, minutes, whereas it used to take us months. And sometimes we develop something for months and no one ever used it. So the experiment box, that is for sort of learning and evolving your own capability. So you may do something that's very easy just to try it out, make sure it works. And then as you sort of learn how to do that, maybe it's the first time you configure a story map. Maybe it's not exactly the highest value thing for your organization, but you do it very quickly and you try out the tools, and then when you're done, maybe you just delete it. So very low effort, may or may not have high value. As you work in that upper right-hand box, you're configuring new things, new tools, new capabilities, getting them out to your users, and growing your own knowledge. That center bar sort of starts to slide because your capabilities are expanding. And that's why you want to stay over there. And in the upper left-hand corner, you want to take more time to plan. So these are more your traditional system integrations where maybe you need to develop some things or bring in external services. It's not something you just want to jump in and do. You want to make sure your requirements are right. You want to make sure that you are delivering business value. So that's sort of the pattern. This doesn't just apply to the ArcGIS platform. Some of you have probably already realized. This slide can be applied to many things, but it fits nicely because of the configuration capabilities that have been built in. Jim?
So
anything to add?
But the only thing I'll add to that is that sometimes when you're when you're seeking to innovate, that you have to conduct an experiment. You have to hear the requirements, and get to an expression of what that capability looks like. But try to reduce the risk and get to that that level of understanding, so that you can push those experiments from the lower right to the upper right, and you can get that more concrete and understood better. So you can build buy-in and reduce risk.
Thank you. So this feeding right off of the project prioritization slide, we have the configure first approach. If you're working on those high value, low effort projects, you're probably configuring web maps, adding in the layers that you need that are for targeted information products, sharing those out as app templates, putting different clothes on your maps, and delivering content and capabilities very quickly. You can't always configure. Sometimes things need to be developed. If you're integrating with your other enterprise systems, other external business systems, there's definitely an opportunity to develop things. But the best practice we're saying here is you should configure as much as possible and then write code last. And I guess the kind of key point there is that the farther you get away from the core, the more risk you introduce. So there are systems that I've been involved in that are still running, and ArcGIS is rev-locked at a very old version because they can't update the system. And so it's because we wrote custom code on top of ArcGIS and made it so tightly integrated that the system can't move on. So we want to try to avoid that as much as possible, make things loosely coupled, and use all those capabilities of the web map and the great tools that are being provided.
Is anyone here familiar with the term code debt?
Ooh, that's a good one.
It's a couple. So along those lines, the code that you write yourself, you have an obligation to, right? So versions change. It becomes a governance challenge. It's just as Ray was saying, that you get into version lock. A key best practice that that I share with a lot of folks is push the configurable capabilities of the ArcGIS platform as far as they go in your first prototypes, as far as they can go, and try to minimize any need for customization as much as possible. And it's at that point when you hit that edge that you've clarified, one, what you can do with the configurable platform, two, what decisions need to be made about what development investments are going to be meaningful, so that you can ultimately carry the least measure of code debt with your solutions.
So was everybody here at the plenary? Based on all those great things that you saw there and us just kind of highlighting this, has your mind changed about what you're going to do when you go back to work on Monday or Tuesday? Anybody going to change the way they work? Or you are already doing it? Okay. Awesome. So kind of the next step to that, if you are working in the upper right-hand box and you are delivering and configuring high-value, low-effort projects, you are able to take advantage of this more agile approach where you are planning and designing, configuring very quickly, testing, and delivering some capability, and then moving on to the next version of that, getting new requirements, adjusting it again. And here, this is saying that you can stop at any point and not lose anything. And so that when you get new requirements, you can just reconfigure and move on. So the key point, each iteration is something you can use. So it's not an interim thing, but something that's valuable now.
This would be one of those another one of those key points to look at as your solution portfolio expands. If you have more people in the organization using capabilities that are tethered to organizational solutions, that you've got a process of continuous development. So again, you want to keep that the investment in each of those solutions as light as it can be, right, and as sustainable as it can be, and continue your engagement not just with with the technology, but with the consumers of the technology, and again, evolving requirements. Because one of the greatest things that happens when you give people solutions that address their key challenges is they begin to like you a lot. And they start asking for more capability. They like to evolve a little bit further. Being responsive in your development cycles is really important. And also delivering the right level of capability without the necessity of extending those development cycles is something you should keep in mind as well.
Oh, and the last key point is you're doing these iterations. If you get to a point where no one's using the capability anymore, then you terminate it and you stop working on it, stop maintaining it. Does anyone find this valuable? Yeah. Good. So like three or four. You have a question?
Yeah.
In the context of the portal, delivering a new information product, which could take you minutes, that process is not as strictly governed as you're replacing a server, right? So that you have some control over it, but it shouldn't take weeks for you to do that. It should be a very quick thing. So that I think that's what we're talking about, is we're configuring things. The capability is already there. So by configuring a new information product, you are not putting the system at risk. Not that there shouldn't be governance there too, but it's a different level. It's not that you have to go back to the board and have them review everything you're going to do. It's a simpler decision.
So along those lines as well, there's, let's say, the broader governance obligation to say these are the capabilities the organization needs to have, right? So oftentimes you design an operational solution to go into production that can grow in production. Right? It can actually extend its own capability for some time within its own context, right? So configuring new information products, adding analytics, in the right scope to support the right solution, that can kind of fit into the broader governance cycle. When we get into the activities within development, and maybe one of the things that you're highlighting here is like a DevOps cycle, right? So DevOps can move in a fairly agile fashion. It requires a certain level of mature capability in the development cycle to get through testing and delivery. But those are those can be fairly focused, modular capabilities that you can stack on top of the platform. In some cases, you can't avoid a slightly longer development cycle because it's going to take a little bit more elbow grease to get all the right pieces put together. So that you've got perhaps the capabilities that you can evolve with through configuration. You've got the rapid development cycles that you're engaged in that might introduce incremental capability that allow, let's say, the initial extension of the initial platform implementation that maybe further refines or extends the business capability to where it needs to be. And then you might have the longer development cycle that says this is the next generation of what's to come, right? And all of those are discussions of governance because they ultimately tie back to the resources that you apply to keeping things moving, right?
keeping things moving. Okay, so we're into the technology piece of the best practices now. Environment isolation. If you're using IT governance, you probably have separate environments for your different capabilities. So this is just saying that the development environment where you may, how did you phrase that? Use them until they break?
In development, you break things until they don't.
Right, break things until they don't. And then you move that to staging, do some testing in an environment that mirrors production exactly. And then when it's completely as bug-free as you can make it, is when you move it to production. So development activities do not occur in production, and you are helping to ensure that your system stays available. Well, I guess it's over there. So high availability. So we said, I think the number was like 8 or 10 people are using high availability. This is simply a chart to kind of highlight the downtime related to the number of nines or the percentage. I think one important point about this is you need to know what is the acceptable downtime. I very frequently hear it's got to be 24/7 by 365. But that is not a service level agreement. That's just a desire for your system to always be up, which is what everybody wants. And knowing that it's roughly an order of magnitude in cost to go up a nine might change how much risk you're willing to accept that your system won't be available. So if you have a system that is in use during the day, so during normal working hours, but nobody uses it at night, then perhaps it's okay not to have four nines because you don't want to pay that extra zero. And this applies to all IT systems, not just ArcGIS. So high availability is meant to improve service delivery, right, and to reduce the risk that your system will not be available when you need it.
Does anyone have an environment where you have different availability requirements? That you're allowed to turn systems off and other systems need to stay running? I think all of you should probably be raising your hands, right? Because in your organization, there's probably some systems that are always on. And there are some systems that can be turned off. And just think about it from that perspective. What's the impact of a system not being available? And I can bring it right back to those six patterns. When we get into those, you know, those engagement patterns, and then we have expectations that the underlying systems are on, that they're serviced and available, that drives how we provision technology to meet that need.
Does anyone find this particular best practice useful? Does it change the way you think about high availability?
I still find it useful, just based on my presence.
This one can't go away. We're actually trying to figure out which ones to improve, which ones to change, which ones to stop maintaining. So you're helping us determine the next generation of our capability. So load balancing, right, a big part of high availability, it's hard to be highly available without being load balanced. And this is just providing users with a single point of access and then systematically distributing the load, whether that is through the ArcGIS web adapter, which does a round robin, so it just dumbly says go to the next one, or you're using your own hardware load balancer that does more intelligent switching and senses loads and all those sorts of things. Some form of load balancing is going to be needed to help you keep your systems available. I guess another key point about that is that the load balancer separates your users from your back-end infrastructure. So there, you may be able to use firewalls in between there. Anybody find this useful? Did I tell you anything you didn't already know? Oh, a couple people. Sorry. Jim, anything else?
No, that's fine. Good.
So workload separation is a key best practice. This is essentially a way to improve your performance, reduce your risk, and it is a best. It's a way of directing your specific requests to a server that is meant to support a particular kind of workload. So, for example, your analysis workloads may go to one specific server. So if you have a geoprocessing task that users are going to hit in an ad hoc fashion, those requests might be sent directly to one server that is maybe a little more beefy and can handle more types of heavy analysis loads, versus on the right side, your constituent engagement, where you have lots of viewers and maybe an unknown number of viewers because, I don't know, your website just got announced on CNN, and next thing you know, you've got way more viewers than you thought you were going to have. They're not going to have slippery maps if you're doing analysis tests at the same time. So you want to separate those two types of loads. So we use the patterns typically to figure out what those loads are. And so if you've got a decision support type of task or information product, and the analysis it takes to generate that, we might help you separate those based on that. Does anyone find that useful? Is that something new? Are you guys already doing this? Anybody doing that? Yeah, a couple. All right, it's like three or four are doing it, and. Yes, it could be at the database level. We'll talk about that in a minute. We call that something different. This is specifically meant for the server. So ArcGIS server for analysis versus an ArcGIS server for visualization. Or maybe it's ArcGIS Online does the visualization for you. There's lots of different ways to do it. It's just the key point is that you separate those things so that your people doing analysis can get their work done quickly, and people trying to look at maps have nice slippery maps and everything redraws quickly. Jim?
I agree.
So to your point, the publication environment is a way to sort of separate your transactional databases from, or maybe your transactional systems from your systems that are maybe providing visualization. So in this example, we're saying use a publication geodatabase to which is a read-only instance of a transactional database, and separate that from your transactional database so that your people who are doing data management are not fighting with the viewers who are trying to read maps. And so that's one simple way to do it. You could also do that by using ArcGIS Online. So you're working on your enterprise geodatabase inside your firewall, and when you finally produce that thing you want, you publish it up to ArcGIS Online, and now people can hit that, and you've separated. It provides an additional bit of security, because now there's no access by external users to your transactional database.
So one of the reasons for considering this also is that there within take this back and turn kind of combine this with workload separation. There have been conditions that we've encountered where transactional edits coming from desktop have run into, web edits have run into visualization requests, and this combination of different requests with different kinds of workloads, and you can throw analysis in there as well. They adversely impact each other, as Ray was saying. A publication environment allows you to isolate the consumption of specific content and the interaction with that content from other activities in the enterprise. So in a way, it's an extension of workload separation. It is a best practice consider that for the audiences that you're communicating with, that you provision content and capability in a manner that gives them the right kind of experience. It's kind of along the lines of your non-functional requirements, right? So your performance at the consumer and performance and scalability for consumers is an essential part of your system design equation.
Anybody find this valuable? Yeah, lots of nods. We'll just say like 15.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Other than replication, what options are available for keeping the tracing?
Yeah, there are too many options to talk about here. that's more of the how, and we're trying to talk about the what. But you can stop up after, and we can kind of go through that. So you've got all these great capabilities, your high availability, your load balanced system. This slide, we've got the S in brackets because implementing one portal, of course, is a best practice because that's how you get the web map. You have a web map, you can configure first. You can do publication strategy by using a hosting server. There's lots of, all those best practices are sort of dependent on the web map. The S means that one portal may not always suffice in your organization. You may have different groups of users who have completely different workflows. So in a police organization, you may have emergency management people who are separate from crime analysts, and those things should never mix, depending on where you are. So this best practice is just about trying to help you make that decision. Do I need one portal or do I need more than one portal? But you certainly need at least one. There are several options. You could have an on-premises portal where you do your work, and as we talked about with the publication strategy, you might also use ArcGIS Online, so then you're publishing up to that. So the public is using ArcGIS Online for some sort of transparency or open data, but your data, your business data is still protected back behind your firewalls. The other option, I guess, for a deployment option would be to host your server in the cloud. So you would manage your server in the cloud, or potentially use our managed services to take care of all that infrastructure for you so you can just do your work. So there's lots of different deployment options, and figuring out where all that goes is part of the strategy. Oh, it's Jim's turn.
So, far away.
I haven't been attending the portal sessions this year, so I just wanted to know, is it still SAML token 2.0, yes or no, as far as the access controls only?
I believe so. Attribute-based access control?
Yeah, or is it just going
to
stay?
Attribute-based access control is something that's been in progress. We have some industry influences that have demanded attention in that regard. that implementation isn't ready for prime time, but it's definitely on the radar for our development team. I can't really give you a timeline in which that'll be ready, but the SAML implementation is still the favored single sign-on approach.
Identity and security is promised to be much improved in 10.5. Stay tuned. I forgot to ask on the multiple portals. Was that valuable to anyone? Did that change the way you think about it? So like 5. We have a scribe in the back in case you didn't realize that.
So you asked earlier about security, and a lot of hands went up. You know, of course, we can identify with secure logins via HTTP. That's one way to get to deal with security. But there are actually security at multiple tiers of any solution, right? So there are considerations for information security. What kind of information is sensitive, and how shall it be distributed? The assignment of effective roles. You mentioned the upcoming attribute-based access control, and it's in place in other systems today, right, that are in industry. This along with identity is key to helping the right people work together in the right workflows to execute the right outcomes. How many of you are working with a landscape of multiple information systems in your enterprise? Most of us are, right? We understand that GIS does not live in an environment by itself. So, access to multiple systems appropriate authorization and authentication and deliver content across secure channels. It's essential for interaction with those systems and making that simple for the people in those engagement patterns, right? So that's one of those items that might end up being out along one of those slightly longer development cycles. Because there's more to work out, right? It's not as simple as I've got all my knowns and I put the pieces together and it works, right? Especially where multiple systems and their implementation details are concerned.
And the key point about this whole best practice is that you should think about that right in the beginning, not in the middle or near the end, but right up front, because that's going to help you avoid having to go back and redo it.
Now, to emphasize Ray's point, there are often times that we get asked before our business requirements are really well identified, how we're going to meet performance, scalability, and availability requirements for a solution, and those are essentially non-functional requirements. Security is often thought of as a non-functional or quality of service requirement as well, but as Ray is emphasizing, thinking about that up front first as you're having your discussions is a really meaningful thing to do, because those requirements are really hard to work out later in the development cycle.
Valuable?
So maybe there weren't too many people in here that were familiar with system tools, right? System tools consist of three components: system designer, system test, and system monitor. And they're there to first design how the workloads of a system ought to be implemented, conduct load tests, and ultimately to monitor operational systems to figure out how they're performing, and when anomalies occur, what should we do about that?
So, Jim, people can now design their own systems, and that's why they don't need you anymore?
Well, There's not really an easy button for that. It does take some work. We have a team within our professional services division that does just this. They also will train personnel to use these tools. And I think this is an essential point for everyone, that system tools, and I'll just digress for a moment. When I joined Esri, one of the first things I did was system design studies. And it was looked upon as kind of a bookmark event where we estimate our workloads and come up with a design for the system. But as we enter this mode of continuous evolution, we need to be able to design and test and monitor systems on a continuous basis. So I would recommend getting assistance from our professional services team in understanding how system tools works, and train the appropriate staff, have them do a study and transition that practice to your team, and then implement that as a practice, something that you and your team do on an ongoing basis to ensure that you can meet the service level agreements that are leveled at your system by the enterprise. It ultimately provides a measure of transparency into the way the system operates, so you can pinpoint key issues that might be interfering with the system's stability and availability, ultimately to reduce risks.
System tools and system monitor will make high availability much easier.
So these tools are actually downloadable, but I would caution against just trying to download and use them. There is a learning curve involved, and that's where I really suggest that that you connect with our professional services folks and get some guidance directly from them. So we went and wrote down a lot of details associated with these best practices, and we published them in a white paper that all of you can access. If you just do a web search on architecting the ArcGIS platform, you'll find a direct link to the PDF, and you can also look in the white papers library off of Esri.com. That will provide narrative details associated with each of these. It's a clickable PDF. In the center there, you see our conceptual reference architecture diagram. If you click on sections of that diagram, it will take you to the associated best practices within the document. And then there's another link to return to the diagram.
I forgot to ask on system tools. Anybody find that valuable? Is that new information? That's good. Yeah, so that was a lot. That was like 10.
Well, that's your question. But what about your questions? Do you have any other questions that we can help answer? The list of questions that Ray asked earlier, does any of this material help you think differently about those items? Yeah? Have any of you thought of a few things that you need to do next as a result of the guidance that we shared here today? Any new information, new action that this has helped you with?
It's all new for me. So,
I think it's helpful to know which questions to ask, particularly IT staff. That they can either assist us with or guide us through.
One question to ask of IT staff, I think, is bring it back to the business capability first, right? So use those six patterns to identify what the needs are, and be able to explain and explore what business capability you seek to achieve, determine what the resources are that need to be brought to bear to build a next generation of geospatial capability, and get the right people and technology in the right places. Does that help?
Three nines. It also auto scales, so when CNN puts your website on the news and a billion people hit it, ArcGIS line is going to scale. You can go to, I think it's on trust.arcgis.com is where the SLAs are.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a there's a page that has the availability, the problems,
yes.
If there's any.
The
yeah, the status, I
yeah.
think. It's
right.
Yep.
Can you go to the environment isolation page, if you don't mind?
I'm sorry?
Environment isolation.
Environment isolation?
Yeah.
Apparently not.
Sorry, the text at the bottom of the screen is really small.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. So, sometimes it is not practical to upgrade everything, especially when things start. So what's like the best practice?
It's going to depend on the new capabilities that you want, or if there are things that maybe there's some security fix in the new version. It's all totally dependent on your situation. I have customers who are still on like 9.3. Other customers are, chomping at the bit to install the latest thing as soon as it comes out. So it's your level of resources, your need for that next thing, all that. I don't think there's a simple answer to it.
I was thinking of putting that into the governance structure, how often we have to create, for example.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're trying to get you this new capability as quickly as possible, but sometimes it's just too fast.
I know it's really the best practice.
Yeah. No, I think it's really dependent on everyone's different situation. You may upgrade your development environment, the day after the thing comes out just because you want to test stuff. But you may not be able to do your production environment that quickly. But if you have all three environments, it's going to be much easier. But if you're only working in production, then it becomes very difficult.
Of course, it's not just a one way from development through staging to production. For a system that's expected to grow in production, let's say someone configures a new geoprocessing task and geoprocessing service, but it's within the scope of the existing system. They might want to take a step back and run that in a staging environment, same configuration as production. But can I stress that and find out what my resource requirements are before I release that in production and knock things over? Right? So coming from development, going through staging, it's good for integration and acceptance testing. But also keep in mind that production moving backward or moving into staging so that you can you can run those tests that are associated with the operational configuration to make sure that, well, you know, that you're clear that you either don't need to provision new infrastructure or you do, right? And, that's a really useful perspective, and you know, I would think maybe 6-7 years ago, before virtualization was as popular as it is now, that was a whole lot harder to do, right? So we can spin up VMs now and imaged machines a whole lot easier, or we can do this this kind of work if we've got a cloud-hosted system in Amazon or Azure. We can do this much more flexibly than we could before.
Any other questions? We have like 4 minutes.
Who's eager to get to the party? honestly, thank you for spending your afternoon with us. If you have any other questions that you'd like to ask us, we'll be around for a few minutes. But thank you very much again for your time and attendance. That's it.